This is John Lothian with John Lothian News. Author Paula DePerna has been in the room where it happened with such luminaries as Jacques Cousteau, Richard Sandor, and George W. Bush. She was inspired by Sandor to try to do something to deal with climate change after hearing him at an event after the Rio summit. As the president of the Joyce Foundation in Chicago, she helped Sandor start the Chicago Climate Exchange and served on the CCX board and as president of CCX International. DePerna joined the Cousteau Society after being gifted a membership and answered an advertisement in the society newsletter for a writing job helping Cousteau with a book that he had a contract to write, The Cousteau Almanac. DePerna was offered the one writing job available and ended up working for Cousteau for the next 20 years. That led to her appearing at the Rio Summit, connecting with Sandor, and ultimately writing her latest book, Pricing the Priceless, The Financial Transformation to Value the Planet, Solve the Climate Crisis, and Protect Our Most Precious Assets. Here is my interview with Paula DePerna, starting with her explaining how she ended up in Rio.
A couple of things. I had worked, extensively with Richard Sandor at the Chicago Climate Exchange, and I met him in 1995, right after the Rio conference. And the Rio conference was 1992, was the first time the world had convened, the UN had convened world leaders on climate change, particularly, and on economic and environmental issues together also. And he was there, but we didn't meet there. We met later when there was a confab to kind of figure out how to fund the output of this big Rio Earth Conference, Earth Summit, it was called. And at the time, I was working for Jacques Cousteau as his policy person, a writer. So Richard was there promoting the possibility of trading, carbon trading for climate change, based on his experience with the SO2 program in the Clean Air Act. And I was there with Cousteau trying to hobnob, get big ideas going, and get these leaders to actually sign on the dotted line for addressing climate change, which eventually they did. And so knowing Richard and knowing what Richard said in 95 at this gathering was so impressive. He said, and these were all bankers and finance people who had money and presumably some power. He said, I don't know much about climate change. I know a lot about trading. And I know what I know about trading is that in order to find out if a product is going to work, you got to try. And why don't we try? And nobody heard that. Nobody picked that up. It just went around the table, people talking about something else. But I liked the idea of trying it. And so it gave me this focus on what does it actually mean? What would it mean to try? And when the first chance I got, which when I got back to when I moved to Chicago, I looked Richard up and I helped him get through the Joyce Foundation, where I was working president of, to get a design going for what then became Chicago Climate Exchange. So that was the kind of kernel of it. And the second thing has nothing to do with carbon, but more or less has to do with valuation itself. And I was in Dublin, great city, and another board role. I was on the board of a foundation, and one of the other members of the board was all excited about Uber. Uber was just coming into the public acceptance, and he was all excited because here was this new system where you could actually get a call a car and have it, in within minutes, and you could watch it on your iPhone and so on. And I thought, boy, this is sort of convenient, but what's the big deal? It's just a taxi connected to a telephone. And then I looked up Uber because there was a lot of hype about the company, and I saw that the valuation was climbing and it was even higher than General Motors at a certain point. And I thought, well, how can we be valuing these companies that are only software, mostly intangible in that sense, in the billions, and we're arguing over valuing the atmosphere, and it's pretty much valued at zero. How does money speak to that contradiction? So that was the kernel of it.
Let's back up here just a little bit. Tell me a little bit about your background, because it's fascinating. Where did you start and how did you find your way to Rio?
So I started my life in New York City and was raised here and always wanted to be a writer. I could say that happily that I was a proud product of the New York City public schools, and I had a couple of great English teachers, you know, particularly in seventh grade and ninth grade. I remember them vividly. And they kind of said, you know, you can write. I mean, they didn't say become a novelist, become this or that. They just said, you know how to write, keep at it. And so I always wanted to be a writer, didn't really know how to get it done, but I was introduced through a professor later on at the University, New York University, to another editor, and I had an idea. I was teaching in the public schools, and I had an idea for a story, and this fellow, Victor Novosky, thought it was a good idea and referred me to a local newspaper called The Village Voice, and they were a kind of rabble-rousing paper, and I wrote a couple of pieces for them on public schools, and it was kind of the beginning of environmental publications, new magazines called Omni and Byte, BYTE, and those sorts of things. And I didn't know too much about environmental issues. And so I thought, well, that might be an interesting area to get into. And coincidentally, completely, a friend gave me a Christmas present or birthday present of a membership in the Cousteau Society, which was Jacques Cousteau's membership organization, one of the early environmental organizations. Included in that was the newsletter, and in the newsletter was an ad asking for volunteer writers and editors to work on this book that Cousteau had a contract for with Doubleday called The Cousteau Almanac. So I volunteered, and the next day I got a call from them saying, you know, we're looking for a writer. You might fit the bill. We have one job to offer. Would you like to take it? And so that was the beginning. I took it, and I ended up staying with Cousteau for 20 years. And became involved in producing films, coordinating the production, going around the world, making sure that the ship and the divers and the cameramen were in the right place at the right time, not to miss a big story. And because in film, it's one thing to rewrite, but in film, if it's over, it's over. And or at least it used to be before AI. And so that was a transformational experience, because most people don't know that Cousteau, when he was in his heyday, which was even before me, my arrival there for sure, you know, 200 million people were watching the same Cousteau film on every Sunday around the world. So a viral message way before our current concept of viral. And that was not only a big influence on me, but also I saw, wow, this is influence. You know, this is how you move a big idea. You get a big idea through a personage and you move it globally. And, you know, that started it. And so it was with him that I was at Rio. He was invited as more or less a head of state. And he was asked very directly by then the head of the Earth Summit, Mara Strong, to help try to convince George Bush to go to Rio, which it wasn't certain that Bush was going to do it. And so we got a couple of meetings at the White House and went there and lobbied strongly for Bush to go to Rio. And the most convincing line from Cousteau, who was a great simplifier, but I shouldn't say simplifier, synthesizer, he just looked the president in the eye. And it was in the Oval Office. So the picture you always see, the two chairs, the sofa, I'm on the sofa with a teacup. Cousteau's in the chair next to the president. They all eat also with teacups. And Cousteau says to the president, and there were staff people there, quite a few of whom were lobbying for him not to go, for the president not to go. Cousteau says, you know, Mr. President, if you don't go, you'll never know what's really said. You won't really know yourself what happened. And it was that idea of being present in your own, you're the president, you should be present. That's what got it home to Bush. So that's how I ended up there.
You want to be in the room where it happens.
Exactly. And one thing Cousteau didn't fully appreciate is, you know, what happens after you leave the room. You know, it's one thing to get in the room and there's niceties and tea and everyone's happy. Oh, great idea. Thanks a lot. But when you go out, the other people come in and they give all kinds of reasons why what you just agreed to might not be the right thing. So that's how things get undone. And more often than not, that's what's happening today in my experience. So you got to be in the room where it happened and then stay there somehow. So Cousteau would leave the room, but I kind of stayed conceptually. It was up to me to do the follow-up because he didn't have a lot of patience for that.
What's the title of your book? And how does it tie back to your CCX experience?
The main title of the book is Pricing the Priceless, and the subtitle is The Financial Transformation to Value the Planet, Solve the Climate Crisis, and Protect Our Most Precious Resources. So the idea of the book is precisely to do that, to figure out a way to price what is priceless, which is an inherent contradiction and paradox. But the point, how it ties back to CCX is, you know, I started realizing, you know, the planet is really like an unpaid worker. It's sitting there doing all kinds of things for us. Water, filtering water, sequestering carbon. The atmosphere, 60 miles of atmosphere protects us from solar burnup. And we don't pay anything for that service. And the closest we've ever come to paying for that service until quite recently is carbon trading, where you're really paying to occupy that 60 miles. That's the principle. You pay for scarcity. And as the scarcity, as the cap defines the scarcity, the space, the supply of space becomes tighter. In theory, the demand to occupy becomes higher. And by the law of supply and demand, the cost of occupancy should climb, which would be one, a deterrent to pollution, the more expensive it gets, and two, an incentive to invest in alternatives. And so that's the kind of structure. And I kept thinking, well, if we can price carbon and cap and trade, figure that out, we can figure out other things. And there are now new instruments, forest resilience bond, coral reef insurance, all these tools that are trying to put a value on what are known as ecosystem services based on a number of things, good guesswork, but more and more quantification technique, comparison with cost. So water filtration, what's the value of water filtration by a swamp? Well, hard to know, except, okay, what are people paying for clean water in that area? What's the cost of the water? And what would be the cost in 50 years if the swamp stopped filtering? You know, those kinds of things. So you can figure out how to price some of this. And then you put, you know, imagination together with rigorous financial design, and you've got a couple of really interesting new things. And I think they're transformational because they get to scale, they get to prevention, and they get people to realize that if you don't price these things at some level, you get what, you know, we have, which is erosion, degradation, risk. And Partha Dasgupta, who's a famous environmental economist, just wrote the biodiversity, the economics of biodiversity. He says it very simply: managing natural resources now is similar to managing your portfolio. It's an exercise in portfolio management. And what we have now is depreciation of our assets. And there's only so long you can go in allowing your assets to depreciate before they lose all their value and they're beyond, you know, beyond recovery. And that's what's happening.
So what happens if we don't price the priceless?
Well, I guess, you know, I don't know. I think for us, our generation and the next generation, you know, probably can get away with it if you have enough money. In poor countries, you'll get more of what we're getting, you know, knee-deep flooding across the entire nation of Pakistan, you know, wars that are generated by drought. You'll get what we have in the United States, 1 in 4 people under a heat alert. So a couple thousand die. You know, it won't be catastrophic, but it will be extremely uncomfortable, and it will get catastrophic if you believe the science, in large part because we're, even for rich people and rich countries, we haven't prepared for it. Bridges are washing out, roads are washing out. You know, we haven't put the budget together to prepare for it, which is another thing that pricing the prices would help us actually gauge. You know, what's the cost of not pricing the priceless? But, you know, you can pretty much buy your way out of stuff. Although, you know, what's the big hotel in Boca? You know, the ocean's just as hot in Palm Beach as it is in West Palm Beach. So at some point, you can't buy your way out.
How does this book tie into the commodities and related markets that are already in existence?
Well, in two very important ways, I'd say, John. One is obviously the process is creating, for lack of a better term, commodities. So let's call a carbon allowance a commodity. The commoditization of air and water. People don't like that phrase, but that's kind of what it is. And when you look at it, you need a kind of public purpose envelope around that. You can't just, stick a price and speculate till the cows come home. But that is one of the keys. But the other important thing, and this has kind of come to me more recently, commodities markets have a structure already. They operate already. They have a regulatory structure already. Traders understand them already. You don't have to invent an entire new structure to do this pricing the prices. You can use the pre-existing commodity structure and the terminology. You just, you have to educate the public around some of the terms because people don't like speculation. They don't like commodity, but they understand, for example, they understand profit and loss statements. So the Puma company, headed at the time by Jochen Zeitz, Z-E-I-T-Z, very forward-thinking guy, he said to his company, okay, we're going to do our 10K and we're going to do our P&L, but what if we had to pay environmental costs? What if everywhere we operated, we actually had to pay the carbon price, the going carbon market price for the manufacturing facilities of our suppliers, or we actually had to pay for water filtration or disposal, because most of their costs came from their suppliers, their environmental costs. And so he challenged his team and he hired some consultants. What if we actually had to pay those costs? And if they actually were priced, what would it mean? And so what it meant was, out of the 202 euros of revenue they projected for that year, 145 euros would have been environmental cost, reducing their profits significantly. And so the P&L is another one of these structures that exists already. And I'm basically talking about an environmental P&L for everything. And you don't have to start all over creating another, system that by the time people learn about it, it'll be another 25 years.
Yeah, in your book, you talk about forest resilience bonds and coral reef insurance. And can you talk a little bit about these and how they work?
Yeah, well, the fire, with all the forest fires and the smoke from Canada, I mean, I guess those of us who only have the smoke are lucky. The people with the flames are the ones really suffering. But, think about it, the whole country of Canada covered by forests. So this forest resilience bond, I think, is brilliant. It was the brainchild of a couple of graduate students at Berkeley Business School some years ago, and they kind of looked at the idea of resilience of a forest, which means protecting and preventing forest fires, trying to keep a forest resilient, which not only means wet in some way, but also not covered and filled up with tinder and kindling and all kinds of things that burn more easily than normal. And so their innovation was to look at who benefits, what's the range of beneficiaries across the various sectors, the range of beneficiaries of a resilient standing forest. So the obvious one is the California Wildlife Service, that has a public budget to prevent forest fires. So the more they can prevent them, the less they, eat into their, the more that there are fires and they have to put them out, the less money they have for prevention. So that kicks in a vicious cycle. Second beneficiaries, you could say, would be tourism operators who want to promote wildlife, wilderness hiking and visitation. They benefit if they don't have to worry that the forest is going to burst into flames just as soon as the first tourists get in there. But what's interesting was who else they fingered. So they started talking to insurance companies, hydropower companies, and discovered that really hydropower companies were very interested in having their reservoirs and their watersheds covered with forest, because obviously forests retain water, and the more water in the water table, the better flow through hydropower facilities over time. And so you can quantify when hydropower falls short, when the hydropower facility might have to buy power from another source. So they began this stack of beneficiaries, and they could quantify over time what the benefits would be worth if that standing forest didn't burn. And they highlighted a relatively small package of trees in Lake Tahoe, and they designed the first bond. And they got private sector investment and a couple of foundations to kick in. The foundations said, okay, we'll take a concessionary return if this thing works. And the private investors expected, you know, non-concessionary return. And they got a $4 million bond put together. And the principle is that the cash comes in from the investors, who the cash goes to the Prevention Forest Service up front, fortifying their budget. They get to work tending the forest, which is a very labor-intensive process, and trying to prevent, the conditions that make wildfire worse. And the idea is, as the beneficiaries realize the benefits, they pay off the bond. And so the investors securitize the risk that the benefits won't occur. And of course, just like in a regular contract, you would have, due diligence about guarantees and verification and what happens if something does happen and the forest burned down. And so they've gone from $4 million face value to the first bond to two $25 million bonds, and they for larger areas, and they are putting that now together, a portfolio of projects. And they're using the same model as is used to fund any other kind of infrastructure. They're big in innovation terminology wise is to talk about the forest as infrastructure, which, as you know, means by definition, you want to protect its value, which means maintenance far beyond what, we might think of, say, otherwise keeping the forest. Every national park, every public forest just never has enough money to protect it. So this puts money in. And, there's really nothing that prevents a series of bonds being issued to protect the entire, for example, forest landmass in Canada. You could have a national version of this. And I'm hoping that that evolves. And then the coral reef insurance is similar in that it tries to sort of innovate in the insurance industry, which, as you know, is mostly based on liability and claims adjustment. This is called parametric insurance. And that means that when there's a triggering event, the claim is paid right there. No adjustment, no haggling. And in the case of the coral reef insurance, the triggering event is wind speed. So it's known that once the wind speed gets to a certain level in a storm, there's going to be a certain amount of wave speed and wave power, and that will definitely smash a coral reef to smithereens. So you can't stop the wind and you can't stop the waves, but what you can do is get into the water right after the storm is over with well-trained divers and go right back down and try to fix the reef. You can't fix everything, but you can fix a major part of the damage if you're down in the water soon enough. And, hard coral is basically cement. So you get in there, a little bit of a drill, you put a piece of coral back, you tie this branch together, and you build Humpty Dumpty back again. Now, why do you want to do that? Obviously, you want that to happen because you don't want to lose the reef. Half of the in the world are dead anyway, already. But the reef is a buffer, and the coastal property needs it. And so, again, you value the hotels and the houses and the factories that are on the coast highly, and the coral reef is valued at nothing. So the insurance is purchased usually by the agencies that are in charge of protecting the reef. And, it's a low cost policy, but if the wind speed hits a certain level, they get money to try to protect the reef. And long story short, because of ocean warming and acidification, 50% of the world's reefs, as I say, are already dead and they're not coming back. So the other 50 are increasingly vulnerable, almost more and more vulnerable every day. And so while you it sounds Sisyphean to keep, repairing reefs, it buys time so that laboratories that are busy at work trying to develop new reef types, new types of coral that are more resistant to ocean temperature, they can get those going and put them back into the reef. So it seems to me, from what I understand, that to protect coral reefs now is just going to be an ongoing combination of Sisyphean tasks like repair and laboratory investment for new breeds. Otherwise, all the projections are, unless we figure out a way to unboil the ocean, reefs are not going to be there. Speaking of, you know, the question, so what if we don't do it? That's a really clear example. We don't do it in 50, maybe 30 years, the rest of the world's coral reefs won't be alive. And, you know, what does that mean? No places for fish to harbor themselves. No, obviously no scuba diving tourism. I mean, if you start thinking about that, physics aside, you got a big number there if the coral reef is dead.
Nemo's going to have a hard time finding a place to hide.
There you go. No Little Mermaid.
So what made you seek out the Pope to speak about carbon markets? Tell me that story.
So that was very interesting. Well, so I've given you, you know my background in CCX and all that I've said about Richard, you know, and it was a slog, but carbon markets, the EU ETS finally got its act together. They, you know, they got over their design phase humps. They started ratcheting the cap down. Reggie in the Northeast was off the ground, not great, but off the ground. California too. You were beginning to have carbon markets operating, cap and trades. You had the voluntary market, which is kind of, you know, different, but as you well know, but is was getting larger. And you had Article 6, the UN, Article 6 of the Rio Agreement was trying to find a way to make rules that would advance these carbon markets and help make them more operational. And just when the Paris Agreement, Paris Conference was about to start, the Pope issued this encyclical, Laudato Si, which was intended to bring the Pope's voice to support the idea of addressing climate change, leaving aside all the abuse and things that are known to have occurred through papal, you know, turning the other cheek, turning an eye from. Leaving that aside, it seemed to me that the Pope was, and so in that Laudato Si, there were a number of paragraphs and comments denigrating carbon markets, accusing them of being, quote, a guise of action. And so I thought, how counterproductive. Here the Pope is going to weigh in just when we're trying to get these markets to actually come together and work better. And so I thought, I wonder if I could somehow get this reversed. And I embarked on a series of telephone calls and letters and managed to the good offices of someone at the UN who worked at the UN office of the Vatican. The Holy See has a seat, not a seat, but a observer status at the UN. And he said he thought the letter should go right to the Pope after he saw it. So he put it in the pouch and it got to the Pope's number one cardinal on climate change, Cardinal Turkson, who after a certain point received me in Rome. I went to Rome to see him and we talked about how we could, you know, square this circle. And by then, other people had begun to question the Pope about carbon pricing, try to get him involved in at least endorsing it as a principle, even if he didn't, you know, endorse carbon markets per se. But I said to Cardinal Turkson, look, if you're so suspicious of all this market stuff, why don't you try it? Why don't you get into it? Why don't you see what it means to be carbon neutral? What it means to buy an offset, what kind of offsets are out there. So why don't you declare the Vatican carbon neutral and just see? And they did. I said, you know, I'm sure there are people out there who would cover the cost. It's not going to be that high. You don't emit that many tons as an off set of offices. And, you know, try, you know, find out more about it. So that did happen. And to my amazement, I don't know if they're still, you know, if they really embarked on it, but they announced that they would. And so I just felt, you know, if the Pope is going to say the wrong things about important novelty, important and novel ideas that have a chance to make a big difference on climate change, then I shouldn't just let that go. And my Cousteau experience taught me you can call the president, why not call the Pope?
You are not one to be trifled with, it sounds like.
Well, I'm a gentle, non-triflable person. You know, I kind of like diplomacy in a way, and I have a good time. John, we're not going to get up in the morning. Somebody tells you, oh, there's an existential threat. It's called climate change. You're not going to jump out of bed and say, oh, I can't wait to jump into that problem. I can't wait to, you know, get dressed and face an existential threat. You know, it's just much better to get dressed and say, I can't wait to try to find something that works, you know. And yeah. As I say, I can't both Cousteau and Richard Sander, I have to say, the same kind of propulsion. And so maybe picked up a little bit from each of them.
What is Jacques Cousteau's legacy at this point?
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, below a certain age, lots of people haven't heard of him because of just the passage of time. He has a number of grandchildren and children who are trying to, you know, address themselves to oceans issues. But the problems of the oceans now are so much more present and complicated and complex that it's hard to know if making films is going to be enough or a public education, because as you say, you can't unboil the ocean. I think one of his substantial legacies, however, is this idea of the beauty of nature. He did establish that without fail, and everybody kind of still understands that part. And so he's given the world underwater filming, underwater images. You know, thanks to him, people pretty much go scuba diving. And I think that in a way, it's a kind of an emotional connection. But he also there are things we've done together. For example, the Antarctica Treaty had a corollary called the Wellington Convention that was about to be passed, and that was supposed to provide environmental safeguards for drilling for oil and gas in Antarctica. And the Antarctica Treaty, which preceded the Wellington Convention, had said no country with a territorial claim, which there are about more than 20, I think 26. So this pie of Antarctica, 26 slices, everybody waiting to jump in, grab their hat, their bit. That the countries agreed they wouldn't, you know, go after their slice until there was this environmental protocol in place, which makes sense. But by the time all that evolved, it was late 80s, early 90s, and things had, climate change was very much more obvious. Cousteau was very, very early to worry about climate change. And we even wrote about it in that first book that I told you I worked on when I was just starting out. And he just felt that it was impossible. He'd been to Antarctica with the Calypso, and he knew that it would be impossible to ever clean up an oil spill down there or ever, you know, he just said there is no such thing as cleaning up or preventing environmental disaster down there. So an environmental protocol that sets out rules is absurd. What has to be done is no drilling or oil. It has to be off limits, prohibited. And so he decided, we read about the Wellington Convention, he knew that prevention of you know, that preventing and cleaning up disasters was impossible. And he said, okay, we're going to stop this Wellington Convention and we're going to establish a moratorium. And he tore this article out of the paper, hands it to me and says, we have to do this. So we did it. And he worked very, very closely with Mitterrand, the president of France at that time. He came back to the States and we worked again with Bush, we had known. And we got Prime Minister Hawke in Australia involved. And we got two or three leaders to revisit this process of the Wellington Convention, this laborious process of the Wellington Convention going around the world to be ratified. And we said, look, you know, when you started this, Antarctica wasn't so vulnerable. Now it's very vulnerable and we have to transition to a full-time moratorium. And we did it. So there's now the Madrid Protocol, which stipulates that Antarctica, the landmass, is a reserve devoted to science and peace. That's the quote. And that you cannot embark in any mineral or oil exploration there permanently, forever. And the only way to reverse that would be by unanimous consent. So every country in the world would have to agree to reverse that. So that, of all his legacies, is probably the most important, I would say, at this time. And I'm happy to have played a role in that.
Very cool. So, so how is the book being received so far?
Well, you know, as a writer, I have to say you never know, but I've had a number of, you know, I did Amanpour and Company. I did a daily talk show here in New York City called Brian Lehrer Show, which they aired it. They interviewed me back at the beginning, and then I just got an email yesterday saying it was such a great segment. We're going to re-air it tomorrow, especially in view of the wildfires. Martin Wolf put it on the Financial Times list of best summer books in economics, even though I hope it goes beyond the summer and it's economics for everybody, not just economists. In fact, it's not really for economists. I'm not an economist, and a real economist would probably trash some of my thinking. But so I would say it's been pretty well received. I did a reading the other night in New York. I'm happy to come to Chicago if anybody you know wants to invite me. I haven't been there in a while. And no, I'm happy so far. We'll see when the sales numbers come in. But the idea seems, people seem to get this idea that doesn't make sense to value Uber in the billions and the atmosphere at zero. It just doesn't add up for people.